I don't know his name because I didn't hang out with in swanky parties, but
Well,
LAing it up, name dropping.
I didn't just call him by his first name. That's when it's really gross. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from Los Angeles, you are Cassidy Robinson.
And today we are going to do a show, a very magic special show, where we review Midnight Special, which both
apparently
of us
with
saw.
Sock puppets as well.
Yes, with sock puppets, even though this is an audio medium.
It's for us mostly. It makes us feel better.
Right. And I'm going to review Richard Linklater's new film, Everybody Wants Some. And at the end of the program, we're going to discuss the penis documentary. And that's what I'm going to call it. The Final Member.
Yep.
I just want to say I'm so glad that I was completely right about that. Because I think I said last episode when you were like, it's called The Final Member, but you're not allowed to read any. If you had just said nothing, if you had just been like, it's a documentary, it's called The Final Member, then I would.
Well, you would have looked it up and then just right away.
Not necessarily.
You do every time.
Not necessarily. Sometimes I look up like director or something like that.
My knowledge, every time that I recommend a movie, you're like, what is that? And then you look it up. And I hear the click, 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 click. And then I go, oh, okay. I'm not making up a movie, I promise. I should do that, though.
That would be, see, I was just thinking that, like, how could, that would be, like, a really difficult prank to pull off, because you would have to put, like, a fake movie tile in the Netflix selection, or else the joke would not last that long. It would be like, oh, I want you to look up Kitten Kubaki, and then I would look it up and be like, that's not real, and then that would be the end of the joke.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm pretty sure if I said Kitten Kubaki, I probably would have ruined it right away, though, so...
Right. Hold on, we have a dog situation.
Well, since we don't record in the same room, I kind of feel like that's you. Like, there's a dog coming in your room, just, like, sniffing all over, and you're, like, just have your hands up in the air, and you're frightened.
No. It's a chihuahua, a chihuahua, but it's it doesn't bark very often, but every once in a while it does. And then we're good now. So what have you been up to? What have you done?
Oh, just had a quiet week. Hung out with some friends, watched some TV.
Is that really noteworthy, TV?
No, not really. That's
was
why,
it live
that's
TV?
Why...
Oh, here, I'll do something with this. These lemons you're giving me.
I don't. My life
do
is
you
pretty boring.
Tend to watch scheduled TV more often, or streaming television more often? Because there's some report that just came out recently that said that. Americans tend to prefer watching things off schedule, either watching it on a streaming service like Netflix or Hulu, and or watching it through their DVR devices and just watching whenever they want. Do you like scheduled television?
Well, I mean, obviously, no. Nobody likes scheduled television. Who watches TV on TV anymore, Cassidy? Like, whoever did this news, like, that you've just magically read, I'm pretty sure it's an article from, like, 4 years ago.
Yeah. or even longer. Like,
yeah.
10 years ago. In other news, water's wet.
Yeah. No, we watched it. Yes, we watched it on DVR. We normally watch on Hulu. And we also stream from Netflix, like the rest of millennials all around the country.
Right.
I think the only people that don't are like baby boomers that live in rural areas.
And that's why they only watch American Idol and The Voice and Dancing with the Stars, is because everything else that's worth watching is either scheduled at a really weird time or competing with those shows I just said.
Right, exactly.
Or streaming on some service they don't know how to use. And yes, I'm basically just talking about my parents at this point.
I think you're talking about most of our parents. Most people's parents.
Well, somebody has to watch those shows. Who the hell watches The Voice? Why the hell is American Idol still a thing?
I see every once in a while, though, I bump into a millennial that does watch them, and I'm like, you're a weirdo. I don't even know how to talk to you as a person. Like, if you were, like, in your 60s, yeah. I would be like, okay, that's fine. But I don't know.
But if you're 25, like, you have no excuse for watching The Voice.
Oh, yeah, I'm judging you. I'm automatically judging you. So if somebody out there that's listening feels judged, you are.
I am judging you through the microphone.
Yes.
But maybe they just have a crush on Adam Levine.
I doubt it. I mean, he's even, like, I don't know. You have to even be an older... I feel like you have to be an older millennial to even know who he is.
Yeah. Kind of at this point. How old of a millennial does it make me that I not only know that he's the lead singer of Maroon 5 and remember when his band was relevant, but I also remember his short-lived indie outfit before Maroon 5, Kara's
Flower.
That just
makes you a music nerd.
Yeah.
Like, you're just like, look at me and my, he was in a band before that. Like, I mean, that was like, you put on the hipster pants, like right then.
Okay, I'll do it. I'll do it. I fit in them well.
No, I hear you. People refer to me as like that too. And I'm like, actually, that's like not even a very like obscure punk band I just mentioned. I don't know.
Yeah, Kara's Flower. They were one of many Weezer ripoffs in the late 90s that didn't take off.
Did you listen to them before he became Maroon 5?
No, I can't say that. No, I think I read somewhere in like an early Maroon 5 review that he was in this band, so I looked it up and like listened to them, and I was like, actually, I like this more, even though it's just a Weezer ripoff.
Well, that's good.
But there you go.
Well, no, I was educated. I feel educated when talking to music with you.
That's what we do on the show every week.
Is you educate me? Is that what you're saying?
No. Educate the masses, the listeners, whoever they may be. Let's get into the show. We have some movie news. I'll read off the first one here. Which one do I have pulled up? I have them both. Charlize Theron, if you're using her South African accent. Is going to be in Fast 8. As the villain, I suppose. I don't suppose. It's confirmed in the article that I'm reading.
Yeah. No, that was the thing. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure it just says it. Why are you trying to confuse me this whole episode? As a villain, sure, why not? I actually am full for it. Because when we watch Snow White...
Yeah.
Snow
White and the Huntsman, yeah.
No, this one, I thought that one was just Snow White. Because the Snow White and the, or, oh, maybe you're right.
Yeah, because remember there was Snow, in the same year, there was,
I guess,
Snow
just the
White
Huntsman
and the Huntsman,
out.
Which was the one with Charlize Theron and, what's his face, Thor.
Yeah.
Chris Hemsworth.
I remember Thor was in the movie, and I remember that Charlize Theron was in the movie.
And they, like, stole all the thunder away from Kristen Twilight. Stewart, who barely registers on celluloid. But on the same year, there was that other one that Tarsem Singh directed that was much campier and like sillier, and it had Julia Roberts in it, Mirror, Mirror.
Didn't it also have the dude from the social network?
Yeah, Armie Hammer. He was a thing in it. Anyway, so...
I forgot all about that. You've just jogged my brain. I was like, oh, I'm glad I remembered that. That was somewhere stored in the junk piles of my brain hole.
Yeah. But you're down for this.
Yeah.
Charlize Theron's like rebranding herself right now as the action chick.
Well, she can chew up the scenery. Like, I mean, she can. So yeah. I'm just like, yeah, I'll let her. She will be a better villain than any villain they've had before, probably, just because of that.
That's true. I'll say that about the Fast and Whatever movies. Some of them are better than others. They kind of all run together in my head at this point, but the villains rarely mean anything. Even like last movie with Jason Statham, you would think that would be like, that would pop a little bit more because he's a known entity. Mm-hmm. But even then, it was just kind of them versus some dude, and then they have to chase a lot.
Yeah.
But I think Charlize Theron could maybe put a little bit more meat on the bones.
Hopefully they let her be like something crazy and insane. See, that's the only thing that I guess I will say the caveat. In the Snow White movie, she's, you know, a big sorceress witch lady that can do powers and yell. Yeah. And.
But, I mean, there's literally nothing there on the page. Like, it's like, that is all her. Whatever she's doing is all acting choices. And then mm-hmm. a bunch of CGI laid on top of it.
No, and yeah, and I'm saying that completely as a compliment. I'm like, yeah. That's what kind of made me like, okay, I kind of like this. I kind of like the visuals of that film, but other than that, it was pretty forgettable.
Yeah, agreed.
Other than they're making another movie, so I have to remember it again.
Baffling.
I don't think so. I think but when somebody has even a little bit of star power, they still try to use it.
Yeah.
They know that card doesn't work perfectly anymore, but they're like, but we got Thor. We're going to make Chris Hemsworth do something.
Right. Like, that's true.
And also, I don't know, this new one has Emily Blunt. So, like, it's like I know they're tricking me.
Yeah.
But it's kind of working. So, I don't know, maybe their star card works a little.
So, yeah, I'm down for this. It sounds good to me. Sure. Okay, so what's the story? Speaking of Snow White.
Yeah, you made me say more about Snow White. Disney's apparently doing a live-action movie with Snow White's sister, Rose Red. Which is sort of weird because it's not really the same. Like the original Grimm's fairy tale, Snow White has the same name, but it's not the same character, has anything to do with the story that we all know
right.
from the Disney classic cartoon. Rose Red is just her little sister, and they're like out in the forest talking with bears and fighting dwarfs, and you know what they do in Grimm's fairy tales.
Sure.
That's all I can basically recall. There's some stuff going down in there, but personally, for a live action, if they're going to keep insisting on doing these, if they're at least going to do something original, I can't complain as much. But it still doesn't, every one of these I've seen so far, I don't have a great reaction to, so I can't really. It's just a zero playing field,
right? Like, the gritty fairy tale movie phenomenon that has never caught on, but for some reason they're still powering on through.
Well, even I'm even talking about like Maleficent, and if yeah. that's what you're referring to as the gritty, and the Cinderella that came out last year. I haven't seen one of these, and so I wasn't excited then when they were new. I'm not going to be excited now. It is interesting a little bit that they're trying to do something a little different by doing it as original, but part of me is just like, they should just do an animation or give it to Pixar.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of with you. I mostly don't care, but I do think it is interesting that they're doing this Rose Red character, which is like kind of coming at this character from the back door. But yeah, so I'm into the idea, mostly because I won't know exactly what's going to happen when I'm watching it. That means a lot to me when I sit down in theater, is to not know every single beat of the story before I sit in the seat. So, yeah, I'm okay with it.
You must not like going to the theater much.
Okay, last story. Ben Affleck is confirmed to direct the standalone Batman movie, which I think everybody kind of called that was going to happen. In fact, I think we had been saying that for so long that part of me was like, wait, wasn't this reported already? And then right. I realized it was just conjecture for X amount of time. But yeah, so this is happening.
Well, it does feel a little bit like duh.
Right.
It's funny, too, because right before this article comes out, they're like, Ben Affleck did write a Batman script. And it's like, and so when they confirm that he'll be in a standalone movie, it's like, I mean, I guess that was a question. I didn't know it was, but okay, thanks. Thanks for confirming.
Right. They confirmed it at CinemaCon, which is happening right now.
So this will be kind of a divider, depends. I kind of was okay with his portrayal. I didn't really necessarily like the film as a whole with
Batman versus Superman.
Yeah. But him personally, I think he embodied the character well. And I think that, you know, that character is okay to be dark and moody. So if you put him in another dark and moody film, I'd be okay.
Right.
Except this time he'd actually be, you know, maybe just in the Batman universe, and I'd be hunky dory with that.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that's what I want to see. That was part of the problem too. When we were watching that film, is like, this is Justice League Batman. I don't want to see that Batman. I don't even really like that Batman very much. In fact, when I see the Justice League, I'm like, what's that Martian Manhunter do? Let's go to for the most obscure, weird character. And what's his story? That's how I get into Justice League. But
yeah,
with specifically this, if it's Batman, he's in his own home turf of Gotham. There's, you know, his rogues gallery. I'm down for. I'm down mm-hmm. for a new Batman movie. Even when they're terrible, at least I'm like, okay, there's still Batman.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think as far as like my biggest problems with Batman v Superman, I think this can only improve upon that in that it has a much more streamlined focus
mm-hmm.
because it is just Batman. I mean, I, you know, never say never. I guess it could end up just being a big convoluted mess full of a bunch of other hints to other movies, because that sort of seems to be the trend anymore. But if they do keep it kind of focused on Batman, then therefore it could focus more on his character, and we can actually have a movie that might have something to do with what he's thinking about. And I want to learn a little bit more about how this Batman ticks. And I want to know, like, actually, one of my favorite things, which we didn't really get into with in our official review, one of the things I sort of liked about Batman v Superman the most was Jeremy Irons as Alfred. And I kind of liked him a little brattier and a little like he had more to do with actually fixing things and a little bit more hands on than our previous Alfreds we've seen on screen. So I'd like to see a movie just about those two and, like, you know, what's that relationship all about?
I'm pretty sure, from what I understand too, his portrayal is based a little bit more on the comic book ones, where he was like ex-military and all that. And he wasn't just a
Alfred,
butler.
That
he was also a bodyguard. He's also a lot of things. And so it also kind of informs you that this character was, because Alfred also like helped train Batman mm-hmm. and he kind of helped him come into his own. So there is kind of a partnership. I like seeing that partnership as well. I didn't even think about that, but that is true. That was kind of a cool, again, I didn't mind some of the Batman stuff. It was just everything else that was going on around it. I was like, man, I'd really like to watch a Batman movie. So I'm kind of getting my wish, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, if the last movie spent half of its runtime trying to justify the reckless destruction of Man of Steel, maybe this movie will spend half of its runtime trying to justify Batman just running around murdering people without any regard.
Again, I think some of it's dreams, and I know that wasn't your problem.
No.
That's more addressed to fans.
Warren's mind when he's driving around with machine guns just shooting people up and blowing cars away.
Well, that's funny because all of that stuff was straight out, like, again, like I said, all of his tech, everything that they introduced about that character in the movie was all from the Arkham video games. And so when I saw this, I was like, oh my gosh, you can't adapt that in. That doesn't make sense. That's just video game logic. They only do that so that you can operate within this world. When you're in a movie, it doesn't work. But I digress. No, nobody cared.
Certainly Zack Snyder didn't.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. Let's go ahead and I'll do my solo review of Everybody Wants Some.
Sounds good.
Okay, so Everybody Wants Some is the new film by writer-director Richard Linklater. And they're sort of marketing this movie as as the spiritual sequel to his breakout hit Dazed and Confused in the early 90s, which actually introduced Ben Affleck to the world. You know, both movies are sort of nostalgia pieces that take place in the late 70s, early 80s, in this case, 1981 or two. And both movies have like a rock and roll soundtracks and deal with young people getting up to shenanigans. And in this movie, whereas Dazed and Confused kind of left off at the end of high school and that transitory period of, you know, the first day of summer and like looking into the future and deciding the person you're going to be. This movie is all about the first weekend before class starts at a Texas university that these characters who are all baseball players, they were like all the the top jocks at whatever school they were from before, whatever high school they were from. And now they've been chosen to be on the baseball team for the year. And they have a weekend before practice starts and before class starts. And they're just trying to kind of get to know each other, size each other up, figure out who's the head rooster of the pack. And, you know, dividing out their spaces and friendships and bonds and hooking up with girls and getting drunk and all of that stuff. And it's pretty much, you know, one of the things I like about Linklater films, or one of the two things I think he's most well known for that usually works in his favor, is he's really interested in movies that deal with the passage of time in some particular way. In the case of Boyhood, it was a movie that took place over a 12-year period, which he shot an actual 12-year time span to accurately portray that. In the case of Dazed and Confused, it's over the course of a night. In the case of Slacker, it's over the course of an entire day, a 24-hour period. And this movie sort of deals with that too. It's over the course of a 3-day weekend, and after every set piece is sort of finished, or after every kind of movement of the film is sort of split, you know, the thirds are sort of split into those weekend days, and it says X amount of hours, 72 hours before class starts, or 24 hours before class starts. The main character is named Jake, and he's played by Blake Jenner, but we also have Ryan Guzman in there. Tyler Hoechlin plays a character named McReynolds, who's like very, very insecure. I guess sort of the unofficial leader of the group, who is constantly in competition and hates to lose. We have Wyatt Russell as, I guess he's this movie's Matthew McConaughey, and he's this kind of shaman-like
creepy old dude.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of unclear exactly how his age amongst the others in the group. Right. But he's, you know, he's this hippie guy who sits in his van and smokes a lot of weed and likes to wax philosophical about this, that, and the other. Wyatt Russell, people might recognize from 22 Jump Street. Glenn Powell as this Finnegan character, who's kind of this modern day Renaissance man who smokes a pipe and has it all figured out. He has all the answers. And I guess in describing these characters, you can tell that another one of the strengths of this movie is that it's very character oriented, a lot like Dazed and Confused and a lot like other Linklater films. And one of the things I was very surprised at, because when I saw the trailer, I thought, like, there's no way I'm going to remember all these dudes. It's just a bunch of dudes. And they're all kind of, you know, somewhat bland looking in that trailer. And this doesn't look quite as like the character potpourri that we usually see in his movies. This looks like a bunch of young white dudes, with the exception of one who is black. But by the end of the movie, I did get a feel for everybody. I did kind of get what their character was all about. And it's sort of an impossible movie to accurately market, because they're trying to market it like it's a comedy. It's a big, fun Animal House comedy. And there's stuff in this movie that's like that, but it's done in that Linklater way, where it's a lot more kind of lackadaisical. It's a lot more based upon conversation set pieces that go on for quite a while, and sort of the way the characters relate to each other through conversation and what they reveal about themselves and about their inner struggles or whatever. And that's not something you can easily market. I ended up liking the movie. I don't think it's anywhere near Richard Linklater's best films, even amongst these types of movies that he's done before. I would also like to say, even though everybody's calling this the spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused, they should also go back, if you can. It's almost impossible to find because it was never put on DVD or Blu-ray, but go back and watch the movie Suburbia, which I thought was already the spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused.
I do think that that's a more honest, I think that's at least somewhat, because it's funny, I think advertising firms are having a hard time, but I think that they should start doing that instead of being like, oh, this is just making sequels and reruns. If they have to like link it to another property that already exists, they should just start doing this. It's like this movie, kind of. Dun, dun, dun.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of lazy, but and I don't think that even Linklater made this movie with the intention of capitalizing on the success of Dazed and Confused, or, you know, the delayed success, because it wasn't a huge hit when it came out. It was like a cult video thing.
Right.
But
I remember when they I remember the advertisements for that, because I watched that and Suburbia when I was a kid, and they were advertised as comedies too.
Yeah, Suburbia really isn't a comedy at all.
Well, I watched both of them for that reason, and was drawn to both of them. But I was like, but I always had that question. I'm like, these aren't really that funny, but I do like them, so I'll watch them anyway.
And I would say that if you like those films, that you'll like this one too. It's very similar to that. To me, it doesn't reach quite as much depth. I think the question that it's really asking underneath all of the beer and parties and discos and, you know, at one point they go to a punk rock show, it's about new experiences, and it's about figuring yourself out. It's about, like, now that you're in college instead of high school, you have this opportunity to redefine yourself. And you can either choose to be the guy that high school said you were going to be, or you might possibly go in another direction. And if it were to believe that this story is based on Richard Linklater's life, which he said is kind of autobiographical, we sort of get hints towards the artsy filmmaker guy that he ends up becoming. So it's okay. I liked it a lot. It's not his best. I could even say you could wait for it. I don't think you necessarily have to see it in theaters, but it's enjoyable.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean, I this is kind of Richard Linklater that I was first drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got more philosophical when he was older, but I was also in my teenage years, so that I was impossible then. So going back, I like that, the more philosophical Richard Linklater. But so this might be a good film for me. From what you've described, I'm like, oh, I kind of can dig that. So
there's also a funny Vulture article that came out a few days after the movie was released, limited, that said that it was one of the most unintentionally gay movies released in a while. And there's something to be said about that.
Okay.
All right. Let's get into the movie that we both saw, Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special.
So basically, this movie is you basically start out kind of on the run. And you're on this run with this boy, played by Jaden Lieber, called Alton, who's wearing goggles. You can kind of guess he's kind of a weirdo.
Yeah.
And he's being taken on the run by Michael Shannon and Joel Edgerton. They don't really, it kind of gets revealed as you go along on the run that he's got some kind of like almost mystical slash sci-fi powers. Mm-hmm. And that's where in the previews, I guess they got off on saying it was a superhero film.
Right. That was a slight mismarketing, but
I understand the trick. This is more kind of more like a Starman or that kind of sort of science fiction movie,
mm-hmm.
where you've got basically a lot of regular people amongst a otherworldly being. And so basically they're on the run from two entities. One, the government, because, you know, they've always got to have their nose in everybody's business.
Sure. As represented by Adam Driver.
And his goonies.
Yeah.
His goon squad. Adam Driver plays this wonderful, like, little side character in it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he's he's this engineer that's just kind of hired out through the government to kind of figure it out. But then you also have this other, like, cult or sect, something like that, you know.
Yeah.
A little Waco, Texas-ish kind of group.
Yeah.
That you learn have kind of been harboring this child for a long time, using him for his otherworldly nature. They end up kind of coming after him as well. So as the movie unfolds, you start to learn more about where he comes from and what he is, this kid. And you know what? I really dig. I'm kind of a sucker for those kind of Starman, science fiction movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really had a lot of fun with this because it was kind of a throwback.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
You could even say kind of E.T.-ish. I wouldn't go that far, but
I would.
again, I I like this. It's kind of on the run. It has some humor. It has some thrills. I also, for me, it was almost, I like the kind of mystical kind of ponderings on how this kind of stuff fits into religion and how it kind of fits into the government and how it fits into our society in general.
Yeah.
And I think there's quite a few like actors that pop up in this. I didn't know that Kirsten Dunst, she also plays a character that's in it for about like a half to a third of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's got some bigger name characters. It's well acted. It's well paced. And I think it's just a decent little sci-fi film. I had a lot of fun with it. How'd you feel?
I agree. I really like this movie, and I love Jeff Nichols. Like he's a director that I often forget how much I like until I see another one of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like I saw his first film a long time ago, Shotgun Stories, which is this very unassuming indie film about a group, you know, a family divided and the violence between them. And it was the first thing I ever saw Michael Shannon in. And I said, hey, that guy's really good. And then for like 5 years, he kept popping up in somewhat mediocre movies, being like, I don't know if I like this movie, but that Michael Shannon's sure good.
He's sure a crazy fellow.
Yeah, and his best work is in these Jeff Nichols movies, honestly. I didn't see Take Shelter, but I would imagine that movie and this movie probably have the most in common as far as stuff in his
catalog. I did say Take Shelter, and vaguely. If you're talking like Bunker Family, but not really.
What about genre films? And
It more centers a lot more on... it does have a little bit of a Take Shelter has a little bit of a vibe, like the thriller vibe to it, but it's mostly kind of a small family drama. It's sure. A little bit more independent. It has some tangential kind of connections, but not, I wouldn't go that far. I saw Take Shelter was my first film of Jeff Nichols, and Mud obviously was my second. I've always been half and half. I liked Mud, but there was a lot of those like coming of age, like summer kid movies, like like more serious versions of the Goonies that came out that year. And I think it was kind of in the middle ground. There were other ones that I liked more that year.
I loved Mud. I thought it was great. And I thought it, you know, that was one of the movies that cemented in me that Matthew McConaughey had really kind of turned an interesting corner. And I one of the things that I thought about Mud when I saw it is, you know, unlike Shotgun Stories, which is kind of a little bit more, I mean, definitely done in sort of an indie sort of way and certainly understated. But I thought that one was a little bit more of a straightforward thriller. Mud, there was hints of what I thought, like, I think Jeff Nichols might be like an Amblin era Steven Spielberg fan. And then when I saw this movie, I was like, Jeff Nichols is definitely an Amblin era Steven Spielberg fan. I think you said E.T. and that's certainly in there, especially with a lot of the visuals. I think this movie smells so much like Close Encounters of the Third Kind all over the place.
I didn't think about that one, but it does have a lot of visual
Structurally too, though, you know, the movie all sort of centers, because, you know, the famous thing about Close Encounters is that Steven Spielberg wrote the ending first, and then he wrote everything around to get to that ending. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Jeff Nichols attacked this screenplay in a very similar manner, because they're both kind of headed to this one point at the end, and there's this kind of journey along the way, and, you know, they're kind of doubting themselves, and they're fighting against this conspiratorial government thing. Like, it reminded me so much of that movie, and especially the tone and the vibe of it, where it has that thing that Spielberg for a long time was the only person I saw who could really do this, where he could make something really eerie and uncanny and kind of unnerving, but also pull you in with this, like, I do want to know what's going on. Like, I would be terrified, but I wouldn't be so terrified that I wouldn't push through to find out what this secret is. I think that's the tone that J.J. Abrams has been working his entire career to get to and never really has, where Jeff Nichols pulls that off great here.
I think so too. I will say it does have heart. I wouldn't say it's as sentimental. He's not as much of a sentimentalist as Spielberg.
No, he's a little bit more of a realist. But there's more sentimentality here than his other movies.
Yeah, there's still a warmth to the film for sure. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that's something that with Take Shelter specifically, I was missing because I was like, something didn't grip me about the story. It was just being shown to me.
Yeah.
Whereas this film, this is the first film that I can completely be like, yeah, I really like this.
Yeah.
Mud, I agree with the Matthew McConaughey stuff. I felt like it was a lot more the actors that I was being engaged by than the actual storytelling. Whereas this one, I think it's all the storytelling. I mean, it's not that the actors did poorly, but...
No, they're good too.
But this, I'm a sucker for the story, and I think it's done well. And I also think that the actors give great performances. So it's really just adds up to this like kind of like... it's just this mid-level great little movie. I thought it was pretty good.
I really liked it a lot. I will say, if it's a movie that all comes down to this big grand ending, the ending does not live up to the Mothership experience of Close Encounters. I'll say that. I say that when the thing that's being revealed is revealed, it's a little underwhelming, but I had such a good time getting there, and ultimately it serves the purpose it needs to serve, you know, at least narratively, which is more than a lot of people can fucking do anymore, that I forgave what I thought was not the most creative production design.
I liked the getting there. The production design did remind me of, what was that movie we saw last year?
Tomorrowland.
Yeah. That's what it reminded me of.
It looked like leftover sets from Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit of a spoiler, and I'm not sure if I'll keep that in the podcast, but yes,
I agree. I think as part of a conversation, it's organic and natural enough. It brings up these weird, almost like pseudo mystical points.
Yeah.
And for anybody that's, you know, I'm a fan of empiricism. I am. But at the same time, when I look at the empirical method, sometimes, you know, there are questions. There are things beyond our perception and beyond, you know, just the means we have to observe this universe by. So it kind of puts on this kind of like, there's only so much you can really prove or look at. And so this kind of like, it sparks that wonder. And honestly, I haven't felt that in a long time in a movie. So for me, that was refreshing. I was like, oh yeah, there can be more. And I don't have to worry just about the realism of everything.
Exactly.
And so
that's that Spielbergian thing that's so.
I don't know if I've ever see, but I feel like I got, maybe that's because this was so new. Because you don't get that in as much anymore. So yeah, it did. It took me back in like a childlike way, but it also kind of, I think, does it in a sort of Spielbergian. But the only reason I'm saying that is the only reason I kind of make a little of a caveat is because even though it is Spielbergian in a nature, I don't think I it's very much his own.
Yeah, well, he does it his way. Yeah,
his tone. Well, see, that's the difference between him and JJ that we were, JJ Abrams, man, I'm name dropping now. There's not that warmness, the same type of warmness. It's not the same kind of thing. It's like he's doing, it's akin to what Spielberg did, but it's not trying to do what Spielberg did. It's telling your own stories. And I think that that's kind of, now that we're in this kind of world where it is hard to kind of step out of bounds of what everybody else has ever done.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way you do it, is you tell the story you are uniquely set to tell, even if it's similar to somebody else, or even to other stories that have been told. Like I said, it reminds me a lot of Starman.
Or Fire. There's a bunch of these movies.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them.
Firestarter. There was a bunch of these movies sort of in the late 70s, early 80s about like you could even say to some extent Carrie, like
Road Trip with an Alien.
Yeah, these movies about like these extreme powerful types who are at odds with the world they're in.
Oh, I'm just
Nicholas Rogue's The Man Who Fell to Earth. Like there was a bunch of these kind of ponderings.
There were, for sure. And the type of narrative it is, there are a bunch of these kinds. And so I don't feel like it's just coming. I mean, maybe it's just coming back around in a zeitgeist way, but I don't think he's just recycling it. Mm-mm. He's telling the story he needs to tell.
And well, there's one scene in particular that is uniquely his, and that brought me right back to Shotgun Stories, in which shotguns are heavily involved in the scene.
Okay.
And that is not a Spielberg moment. That is very much a Jeff Nichols moment.
Right.
In his sense of thriller making and timing, you know, he can turn on that dime really fast.
And there's, where Spielberg is almost more of a...
I mean, he...
Spielberg does too, more of like an action adventure kind of way.
Yeah.
His turns are much more like thriller sort of turns. Yeah. So, and balancing those two is also, is an interesting dynamic
mm-hmm.
between the lighthearted and the mean.
Right. And this is the best I've seen Joel Edgerton do in a long time. Like, I mean, he was in that movie, The Gift, last year that everyone loved. I never saw it, but, and I mean to still because it was so highly well regarded. But it's been a long time since I've seen Joel Edgerton do something in somebody else's movie that I was getting to the point where I was like, was I mistaken the first time I thought he was good? But he was really quite good in this movie.
Yeah, I feel, for me, it's always been more the movies he's in than necessarily his performance. Yeah. But nothing has ever been like him chewing up the scenery either. He's just kind of been like, well, he's there and the story is a little underwhelming and he kind of comes off a little underwhelming.
Yeah.
But there's never been a time I was like, wow, he was awful. So for me, it is true. In this case, I do think he really does stand out. Adam Driver gives another great performance. And yeah, I mean, he's really not a huge,
essentially playing Bob Balaban's character from Close Encounters.
But yeah, so I think we're both, at least, you know, we all think you should go see this movie.
Yeah, this is a cool one. And, you know, one of the cool things I really liked about this trend lately is these kind of these indie-ish, even though this was released by Warner Brothers, these indie-ish kind of mid to low budget genre films that have come out in the earlier months. Like, this has become my new favorite time and place in movies right now.
Well, they've been able to, these little indie budget films that kind of come out through Sundance or one of those, one of those festival crowds, they're able to, because of where technology is, we complain about it because, you know, things are so CGI filled, but at the same time, at this level, a very small film can get away with making movies that, you know, would be huge budgeted things in the, you know, 70s and 80s. And so it's sort of a strange dichotomy right now. So I'm excited to, as it continues to progress, that there's more of these interesting genre pieces. But this one is an excellent one. And I think I highly recommend it to most people. I would say that it is a little darker than maybe some of the ones we mentioned.
Yeah.
I would say that more dark than Starman or I keep wanting to say Hitchhikers, but it's not that.
Close Encounters.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
It's a little bit darker than that, so I don't know if it's necessarily, some kids might have a problem with it, but if your kids have a easier time with like darker matter, I would say even let them watch it still too.
Yeah, this is a good like middle ground as far as that kind of thing goes. Like I could see me really liking it when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, me too.
Yeah. And now.
Yeah, and now as a giant child. Sure. Yeah.
Let's get into the Netflix homework.
Sounds good.
And this was yours.
It was mine.
The Final Member is a documentary about an Icelandic eccentric who has this fascination life goal of adding to and collecting for his penis museum.
Right.
And it's exactly like what that sounds like.
Well, maybe not exactly.
Maybe not exactly. It's not a like dildo museum or anything like that. He collects,
has like animal artifacts and things like that.
He collects the members of a bunch of different animals from across the globe of all varying sizes, whales to what was the smallest, a hamster?
I think so.
That was like 2 millimeters or something. You had to actually look at it through a magnifying glass.
Right.
And seals and all sorts of crazy things. He walks with a cane. He's a little bit older now. He's in his 60s. And he's walking with a cane that's made from the bone of some penis.
It's the bull's penis, I believe.
The bull's, yeah. That was the first one he ever had. So he has some sort of sentimentality about it. But he isn't going to be satisfied until he completes his collection with the first male human specimen. And it's a little harder than you would think to obtain a human male penis.
I bet it is.
a dismembered human male penis. The other kind would be super easy.
Well, that's the thing too, is like, you don't think about I did enjoy that part of the, that part of the documentary where they were kind of like going into the ins and outs and the international law of having like collecting like a real human penis.
Right.
So,
because you think like, you know, there's a bunch of people who just go to hospitals and like will claim skeletons for science, will claim this and that and the other for science. But because I guess we're talking about sort of what the movie's about at this point, because there's this strange distinction between what the penis is and does and is for, and how it's connected so much to a male sense of masculinity and a male sense of and the human perspective of this kind of thing that should be hidden or not seen or sort of, you know, there it's a very loaded human body part. Figuratively so speaking, and there's a lot of associations attached to it that come from every societal thing, whether it comes to, you know, just like I was talking about masculinity or in the case, you know, spirituality. A lot of things are connected to the penis. Mm-hmm. So because of that, he's having a hard time finding one. He has two prospects. There's one, an older gentleman, who's like a playboy type from the 50s. Who
adventurer,
this world traveler adventurer who's kind of somewhat of a celebrity in Iceland, who's about to kick the bucket.
Almost but, straight out of a Wes Anderson movie, yeah, I would say.
Definitely.
Like that kind of a character.
And then there's another guy in Texas who's about the most American person you can think of, who might be a little bit of a pervert. And might be a little bit of an exhibitionist and might also have some medical issues, but he's really excited about the idea of getting his penis in this place before this other Icelander. This is one of those documentaries, I think, a lot like A Fistful of Quarters, the King Kong, or the King of Kong.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Or even Errol Morris's Tabloid, which I think they're kind of documentary comedies, where you just show these people in their natural setting, and you just, all you have to do is tell the story, and it's so, truth is stranger than fiction, that it just ends up being intentionally or unintentionally hilarious. I think in this case, the guy knew what movie he was making. Mm-hmm. And he really plays up these characters, especially, I want to get these names right. Was it?
Oh, good luck.
Yeah, what was the name of the American dude? Tom Mitchell. He is a documentarian's wet dream. Like to get a subject that ripe for where all you have to do is just film him talking and you're getting gold.
Well, you also, he is sort of like, if you've seen Tabloid, he's kind of like the ladies. He might be slightly insane. As you unfold this kind of story, I love documentaries about the most eccentric of the world. Yeah,
the truth is stranger than fiction type.
Yeah, and I've got to say, I was just... it's funny because it does a lot of different... It does some different tones, I would say, because there's also kind of that existential, like, what is the fulfillment of my life's purpose kind of thing.
Yeah.
And all of these characters, all the three main... because you mentioned all the three main ones, mm-hmm. are all struggling with that.
Yes.
One wants to have, you know, a human penis for his museum. One is like an adventurer who wants to be, you know, remembered. And the other one, I'm not really completely sure of his motives, because they're all over the place.
I think it's a posterity thing as well. I think one of the interesting things is that's a subtext that's kind of laid out there is he sort of in a way comparing the Nordic or Northern European kind of, well, no, that's not Europe if it's Iceland. That's just Nordic, I suppose, or Scandinavian. That kind of perspective with American exceptionalism. Right. Even to the point where this Tom Mitchell fellow gets a tattoo of the American flag on his dick. Right. Like, I mean, there's
not dresses it up in outfits.
If that wasn't real, if this was a narrative, that would be too on the nose. But it's there. I mean, and you know, like, there's a lot going on with that guy, like, for sure.
Oh, he could be he's like a Will Ferrell character to the max.
Yeah. Like, it's that ridiculous. But it's also like, you know,
but he's a real human being.
He's a real human being. But comparing these two people and these two different worlds they come from, the lifestyles they come from, there is a sense that there's a slight political nature to this comparison that the documentarian's making.
No, I agree. There is almost like a globalization, a globalization of the market kind of subtext running through it, as well as that existential one I brought up. I think he's doing both.
As well as a lot about masculinity in general.
Agreed. So I think this has a lot of...
The whole idea of the legal size.
Yeah. Well, this might be challenging for some. I found it hilarious and sort of informative and sort of, I think it had a lot of heart as well. Mm-hmm. It also reminded me of, I like these little documentaries. Like we did another one on the podcast, American Scream, mm-hmm. about little like scary, scary houses people build at their homes. House haunts, if you will, is the more non-condescending way to say that, I suppose. this film is kind of in that same vein. I can't help it. I'm even laughing at myself. They're so much fun, but you're still being informed and you're still kind of looking at life. But what you kind of realize is those natural stories that kind of exist out there and how life still informs us. I was super in love with the little Icelandic adventurer man.
Yeah.
He was so adorable. And just like the life he led, like I said, he was straight out of a Wes Anderson movie.
Even though he was a huge womanizer?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, those characters exist too. Like, I kept thinking of the Budapest Motel the whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, that character also was kind of a womanizer.
Kind of a Hugh Hefner type. Like, not as rich and not as business savvy, but like had that kind of vibe.
I take him for what he is.
Yeah.
And from where, what time period he's from, where he lives. And I find him to be kind of fun, a fun character. I don't think he has any malice or anything like that for the world. I think he just led his life like he was going to live it.
Sure.
Like I said, I think that this has a lot of heart. It's very, just very interesting and very kind of informative to watch and be like, okay, But at the same time, again, I love how just straightforward it is. Yeah, it's a penis, big deal. So there are a lot of different aspects and a lot of different things that this documentary is inspecting mm-hmm. under just this very, just watching this natural story unfolding.
Sure.
So I would recommend this if you're not into nudity and you're afraid of the penis, this is probably not the film for you.
Well, I'll say that even if the goofiness isn't too big of a factor to keep you away, I will say the squeamish part of me, there's some stuff that I winced, but I think overall, I agree with you. This is a really funny documentary, a more insightful than it sounds, from the subject matter and, kind of really well made. And it's not too long. It's like 71 minutes. So it's like, it gets you in and gets you out just quick enough.
Yeah, no, it's a very pleasant, I would say fun. And unlike Tabloid reveals it is masterfully done. It's Earl Morris. I mean, you don't get better than documentary than Earl Morris.
Yeah.
But his like that reveal, the reveals in that are a little bit crazier. This is just as crazy of a world.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that this one is just, I liked how kind of light and breezy it was. And I, again, if you like to see just kind of the eccentric people that live in our world, I think this is a great documentary. I would say that people should kind of try to kind of just break out of that idea of it being a scary penis. Even though at times they are, they're, you know, horrifying in their little glass jars or attached to the human beings that they belong to.
there really is. I mean, considering what it's about, there isn't that much full frontal male nudity.
There's a couple of parts that are.
Yeah, there's some where they kind of can't avoid it, but it's not like it's just a dong in the face every minute.
Well, I would say it's not a dong in the face every minute, but it is. Dong. Yeah, that's true.
If you're really, really sensitive about whale penis, like you get an eyeful of that.
Whale and hamster and field mice and deer and bull. And
it's not so mawkish that it's giggling the whole time there. You know, once you settle into the subject matter, there is more to it than that. And there's all, and like I said, it's economically made and it's well told. Even though it's not narrative to storytelling in the same way that we think of something like Midnight Special, where there was a script and, you know, takes weeks to prepare and da da da. Documentary filmmaking, just like anything, is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you still have to know how to economically tell your story and without dragging too long or focusing on the wrong parts or shaping the footage that you've captured in a economic and interesting way. And I think that these directors, Jonah Bekor and Zach Math, they did that very well here. And I think that it plays at least as good as some of the Errol Morris stuff I've seen. I think it's about at that level.
It made me laugh so much.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there were a lot of cringeworthy moments. Oh, man. Santa penis and like that. When that happened.
You can't unsee that.
You can't unsee that. But it really, again, when it taps into that global, like, subtext, the global marketization subtext and some of those, that's when I really, like, kind of flipped and say, okay, this isn't just a gag kind of movie like King of Kong, which I think is still a really good documentary, but it's mostly about joking and trying to be the best.
Right.
This I think has a little bit more to it. And so I encourage people to watch it and, you know, learn about our world.
Yeah, definitely. Next week for our Netflix homework, I'm going to have us watch the British comedy, The Trip. Heard a lot about it when it came out. There's even been a sequel. It did so well. And
that Coogan fellow's in it.
Yeah, so Steve Coogan. He's in there.
So I'm interested to go and see it.
And if anybody has anything to say about any of these movies, Everybody Wants Some, Midnight Special, The Final Member, or The Trip, or you have anything you want to say about the show in general, compliments, we like those, go ahead and send it at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also contact us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us there. You'll see all the news stories we post, some of which we talk about, some of which we don't. We're also available to follow on Twitter at JabberPodcast, all one word. Tweet at me there. I'll probably respond. And you can also suggest Netflix homework. We have some people listening now that who like that segment. If there's something you want us to talk about, go ahead and suggest things. If we've already seen it, we'll tell you.
Or if you're worried about watching a film and you're not sure about it,
and you want us to take that on for you.
Yes, we will do that for you out in the audience.
But you have to tell us why.
No, you don't even. I don't care. You don't have to tell us why. You just have to. You have to say this movie. If it looks horrible, then maybe we won't. But
right,
if you just suggest bad movies every week, then I'll be mad at you. But and we'll know who you are. We'll figure it out.
My Little Pony, The Aquarian Princess.
We should try it. Bronies love it.
Sure.
We need to understand our brony listeners better, Cassidy.
Maybe
we should try some My Little Ponies.
Maybe. Okay. You can follow us, or you can find our podcast archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can also find us on Stitcher and iTunes, where you can leave us a star rating and a one sentence review. We're also available on Pocket Casts, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network. My written reviews are archived at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I also have some content available on the Seattle-based entertainment website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And I guess Brad Decker, friend of the show, Brad Decker, who is used to do the Quarter Life Crisis podcast with Alyssa Whitty, who's also been on the show, and Amanda Kowalski. They have their magazine, the Panel and Frame magazine, almost printed and ready. I saw the art, the cover art. Pretty snazzy.
Neato.
Looks good. It looks impressive. I think they're still just trying to pull together some funding, and they want to do a run of 1,000. So check out what they're doing over at their website, medium.com/panel-frame. And go ahead and listen to our other friends out there who do podcasts, such as Leland Brungart of the comedy podcast Dampercast, dampercast.com, Rod and Denise at their Music Request podcast, The Listening Party, and Patrick, who was on the show recently for our episode about Batman and Superman, at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. And we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.